Welcome to another edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. Among other things, hosts Lorene Jaffe and Mike Deason will be remembering Ruth Bader Ginsburg and talking with noted Jewish artist Janet Echelman. Before we get started, a brief reminder, make sure you subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Now, here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you are listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Hey, listen, we have a ton of things to talk about on today's show, but before we get started, I really want to address an issue from last week's show where we played a clip that I believe to have been from Michigan Congressmember Rashida Tlaib, but it was not. The clip was actually part of an internet hoax disparaging the Congresswoman, and I'm really embarrassed to say I fell for it. There's only one person to blame for this, and I am the one that is responsible. And I really do deeply regret casting Congressman Tlaib in a disparaging light. And perhaps more importantly, I'm upset with myself for giving our listeners, you guys, information that was not true. On the Third Opinion, we try to bring our listeners information that we think is important for you to know. And sometimes that involves people saying things upsetting to the Jewish community. However, I want you to know Lorene and I want you to feel confident that the information we give you is factual. And in this case, it just was not. As I said, I deeply regret it and never intend to let something like that happen again.
And
anyway.
Mike is such an amazing journalist, and I think both of us, it was just rather unfortunate. And we want our, the one thing I could tell you, we work so hard every week, and go through a tremendous volume of data looking at sites, and we always want our audience to feel confident that what we're providing is credible, competent data, and so.
But it wasn't.
Which is why we want to make sure that you knew, that we are sorry that went out, and we expect better of ourselves, and hopefully that will never happen again. And,
right.
But anyway, we do.
First of all, we're taping this on Friday, but it's Sunday, and so now Cold Midray is tonight.
It is.
And again is going to be different because of the virtual services everywhere. And
well, we should explain to people what Cold Midray is and Yom Kippur. I think there's a lot of confusion out there, sort of what Yom Kippur is. I think people think, you're taking off work, it's a holiday, blah, blah, blah. No, okay, let's be really clear. It is a high holy day. What we learn is that, when we were in the wilderness and we were out at Mount Sinai and Moses was on the mountain for 30 days with God and he comes down, because he was gone for so long, we had built a golden calf, which was an idol that had been worshipped in Egypt. And he literally, crashed the tablets down and then went right back up the mountain for 40 days to seek God's forgiveness. And the result was that 40 days, it comes down as Yom Kippur. And so, Yom Kippur is really this time where it was a gift given by God to say, I'm going to give you a clean slate. You're going to start the new year, free. There's even in the years of every 50 years, it's a what they call it, a jubilee year on Yom Kippur when they would sound the shofar would mean three things: you freedom from all your debts, restoration of your land. If you had sold yourself into indenture to pay off a debt, that you would be freed. So it's just really this tremendous full restoration, and so it's a day that. Not only do we individually, as we have spent the last 40 days, as we went through the month of Elul and we came into Rosh Hashanah and these days of awe, a time of inward inflection and repentance, that is a time of individual repentance. But as you and I have talked about, Israel is the only nation in the world where we're really sort of Kol Israel, old Israel, where we come together as a people globally and repent on behalf of the nation of Israel, on behalf of the people of Israel. So it's really a time to ask for forgiveness, to forgive people, and just a beautiful day of really saying, God is good and he's giving us this fresh start for the new year, that we're completely free.
And, you know, my favorite prayer, one of my favorite all-time prayers, but that is recited on Yom Kippur, is because we ask God to forgive us for our sins and write us in the book of life for next year, is that God will forgive you for the sins you committed against him, but he won't forgive you for the sins you've committed against other people unless you go to that person to whom you've wronged and say, I'm sorry, ask for my forgiveness. I think that's, I'm paraphrasing how the prayer is written, but right. But the thought behind it, I think, is just tremendous. Before we move on to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because obviously a big thing, what I'd like to do, I don't know that I mentioned this to you before we got started. I forgot. We were talking about a lot of things. I thought the services were so beautiful last week, and I looked at some of the other online services besides the one at Sherazadek. I mean, everybody did a great production, and so much goes into that. I mean, I know I spent 50 years doing stuff like that, and they came off flawlessly, but my favorite thing, at least from the Sherazadek service last week, or one of the favorite things, was when the choir sang a song that they recorded in their home. You've seen this before, like on a Zoom conference with people, and they
That's
all
right.
had their headphones and the music, and it came together. It's a prayer, Elohai Nisor, which is me, and it says basically, make my words be good. Let my words come out right. And I thought it was so beautiful. I was so inspired sitting with my headphones listening to this off the computer, and I never thought I would be. But
it really was beautiful. It was like, right. I think many of us felt like that we were right there with our community and our family. And the service was really beautiful. And I know people felt that way across the country. I'll say our own general manager, Rick Fernandez, I learned he actually directed the Tree of Life Synagogue in Philadelphia last year. He actually had produced, directed their Rosh Hashanah service last year. I guess they did something similar online. But a really special, special time. And I know families will be gathering again and for Yom Kippur. I know that Chabad right now, Chabad of Tampa, they actually are having live services. They set up a huge tent outside with social distancing and everything. So for those who are more observant and practice that they can't use electronics on the holiday, that they can walk to the shul that's been set up outside. But, you know, speaking of that.
But I want to play, let me play this clip first, okay?
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, let's listen to this because it is just beautiful.
Hello.
So I know they put in a ton of time. I can't imagine the amount of time, the pre-production that they had to put together, not only for that particular clip, but everything else they did. And again, it was just beautiful. It was meaningful, which I was concerned that it wouldn't be, but I certainly found that. And that's what I heard from other people in our community and at the other synagogues throughout the Tampa Bay area.
Yeah, so, and I was going to say, unfortunately, you know, last week in Canada, we saw there's a very one of the largest Jewish communities in Canada, just outside of Toronto. There was, you know, families that were walking to service on Rosh Hashanah that were being, you know, verbally attacked. And then there was also some vandalism with, you know, there was actually somebody wrote like Jews. So not only was I was saying, you know, verbal attacks, but then there was vandalism where someone wrote like Jews run the world on cars. They were like spray painting on cars, and then one of them wrote Jews hate blacks, like just trying to like, and I don't in like, you know, cursing at people. I just thought that this was just, you know, sick world in these people. So
you know,
really unfortunate that
every
happened.
Week we have a story about anti-Semitism in Canada. It surprises me, but obviously it's boiling over
everywhere in
Canada. It's everywhere. Okay, a sad but happier subject, celebrating the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean,
a tzaddik. I mean, of you know, I say of righteous memory. There's all this debate now going on. You know, was she a tzaddik? I say yes. I think.
Explain what that is, Laureen.
A tzaddik is a righteous person. So we say of normally we say of blessed memory, but of her we say of righteous memory. But I think she did. I mean, she so embodied so much of Jewish tradition and thought, and as not just, you know, a Jewish woman, but as a justice leader. You know, she wrote, I guess in 2017, she had spoke at a Rosh Hashanah service in Washington, and she said, the Jewish religion is an ethical religion. That is why we are taught to do right, to love mercy, do justice, not because there's going to be any reward in heaven or punishment in hell. We live righteously because that's how people should live, and not anticipating any award in the hereafter. And that really, and you and I have talked about this, you know, what does it say in the Torah, in the Chaf Torah, it says to pursue justice and love mercy. And I think this is, she's such a, when we look at her lifelong career and what she did for women's rights and minority rights and so many different ways, she just tried to embody those, the very essence of Jewish values. And I, you know, I think, you know, just really, I think all of us just sort of sit back in awe as we honor her memory this week.
I mean, we all do. And as an attorney, Laureen, there's a little extra special meaning, I would think, to...
Definitely. I mean, I think it's a passion for justice. I mean, I think so many of us, when we you know, go into law, because we have this love, this passion for justice, and which really goes back to that compassion for humanity, the desire for mercy. And she embodied it, and you saw it in her dedication throughout her life to these principles and values. And I think that's, you know, I still think that's why so many Jews end up being lawyers.
Jewish lawyers? I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of Jewish lawyers. And you know what I also love is, so New York, I think the governor announced that they're gonna put up a statue in her honor in New York. So
right,
that would be really wonderful for her. I'm just, you know, all of us, we will miss her dearly.
I was watching the memorial service this morning. It was, they were putting her in the Capitol to lie in state. The first woman, first Jewish person to lie in state in the Capitol, which that surprised me, but. So just
isn't that amazing? Which, by the way, like, I mean, I guess we should also explain that for people listening, because under Jewish law, like we bury right away. So very unusual for her to be lying in state for a week. We normally within like 48 hours. So this is very unusual. But I think I read a quote from one of the rabbis that said, you know, this. It required this kind of unusual circumstance because of who she was, to give people an opportunity to pay respect and honor her and express, like, you know, who she was to them. So certainly an unusual deviation from what would be a traditional practice. So yeah, so very interesting. But like, you know, but a lot of good things happened in the world this week. You know, I saw, did you see that one story about Israel helping out Chad?
Yes, absolutely.
So
they needed supplies, right? Go ahead.
Yeah. So there's an organization, Israeli Flying Aid, is a charity. Israeli Flying Aid, along with the American Jewish Community, donated thousands of tents and food and supplies. And by that I mean, let me see, it was like the personal protection equipment, 6-person tents, medical teams, backpack sprayers to eradicate malaria, because apparently there's severe malaria. They had sent tons and tons of healthy food supplies, but they said in Chad, you know, the Chad is being impacted tremendously because they have a lot of the refugees that are trying to escape Boko Haram and other things that are happening in that area of the world, the you know, in essence, a lot of the bloody wars that are happening, and so Boko Haram, Muslim jihadis, and different things that have been, these people have been victimized. So there's almost 30,000 people there living in refugee camps. And they have a lake that overflows, and so there's all this malaria that's happening. And so they've been able to supply like over 40 tons of food and different things. So in this article, it was in Israel 21C this past week, they were talking about the really the current condition, I guess, you know, because it's not getting a lot of media, a lot of press, because everybody's focused on COVID and so many other things going on in the world. But, you know, they're saying that these people, you know, the refugee crisis is serious. The health crisis is serious. So very proud of the AJC and IFA.
And things are thawing in the Middle East, thankfully, or so it seems. I mean, the World Israeli News reported that Saudi Arabia is warming to a peace deal. I mean, that is
exactly
astounding. That is astounding, and that is so important because Saudi Arabia is such a force in that part of the world. So that is that's an encouraging note.
And there's lots of encouragement there. I mean, you know, I think the Saudis, you know, look, they've got their own internal politics that's, you know, going to make it difficult for them to come right out immediately. But I think, you know, but the U.S. envoy to the U.N. At least alluded to the fact that they were expecting a new peace deal in the very near future, meaning like in the next couple of days. So we'll see what happens there. We do know that Sudan and Israel met in the UAE this week. No agreement was finalized there, but you have to understand like how huge it is that Sudan, which, you know, you think of the Khartoum conference, Sudan, where the Arab League voted no to everything when Israel was trying to reach some peace back in the 70s, and then Sudan that's been technically, you know, had been technically at war against Israel. And yet you see this warming of ties. We know that there's been communications going back and forth. Leaders have been meeting for probably the better part of last year. You and I have been talking about on air. So really interesting to see, like, if Sudan normalized ties with Israel, that would just be
spectacular.
Unbelievable.
It would.
Unbelievable breakthrough. Like, tremendous, huge breakthrough.
And speaking of the UN, former UN ambassador Nikki Haley this week praised Trump for ignoring the Palestinians in putting together the peace deal. I thought that was pretty interesting. She said he just went around them, and that every world leader, every president in the past has tried to include the Palestinians in their peace deal. And she said Trump just said, "Nope, I'm going to do it. Go ahead and do it." And obviously the Palestinians are not happy about it, but she said that she thought that was the key. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it goes back to sort of what is it called? The quartet, you know, like Tony Blair and so many other people were talking about, have been working on for so long, like, you know, present it from a different perspective. If we keep trying to do it the same way, it keeps failing the same way. Every time we try, it keeps failing. Like, let's just try something radical and different.
Yeah, it's the Einstein quote. Insanity is the definition of doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results. You know, it's just...
Right, like, it's going to come the same time, same way every time. So, you know, unless you have different people involved. But, talking about different people, I think what was really interesting, you know, it's been a while. We mentioned his name before on the show. So Mohammed Dahlan, he's from Gaza, but he was the head of security or the chief of security for Fatah for many years in the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority. But he's been living in exile in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, since 2011. And there were some grumblings a couple of weeks back. I think we talked about it where the Palestinian Authority was saying, oh, this, you know, because Dahlan is, you know, is considered an opposition threat to Abbas, the president of the PA, the Palestinian Authority, that there's some grumblings like, oh, he's behind all this normalization with the UAE. And of course, there's been nothing validating that. But there is an article this week in Times Israel and a couple of the other news outlets in the Middle East, as well as in Israel, talking about this. So Dahlan's associates, you know, because he obviously still has a lot of followers there in the West Bank, but apparently there were reports of dozens of arrests that were happening for Dahlan supporters in the West Bank, because he is considered as a potential contender. I mean, Abbas is 84 years old. I mean, for the love of God, he's like Farrakhan. These guys just like live forever, and they just don't stop. They've had like endless energy. And he's, you know, but he's 84, and, you know, everybody's sort of like, well, who will replace him?
And he is.
But Dahlan is considered a threat to his establishment, you know, but he's, but so it'll be interesting, but apparently many of his supporters were rounded up and arrested by the Palestinian Authority this week. I don't really know what they could be arrested for, but I don't know that that matters.
Yeah. Who knows?
But interesting, you know, that there is this, you know, you and there's a couple of think tanks that were talking about it too, like saying, could Dahlan be, you know, like the next leader? He has a great relationship with the UAE. You know, he doesn't condone normalization, but at the same time, he respects the rights of other nations to do it. Like, is this somebody who would approach a peace differently?
Also, and gee whiz, I don't think I would ever say I would agree with John Bolton, but remember I brought up something a week or two ago saying that there were some
never
folks...
Never say never,
yeah,
Mike.
Never. Well, I don't know if I 100% agree with it, but I think there's a grain of truth. I talked a couple of weeks ago that some people were saying that the nations in the Middle East that are agreeing to peace talks with Israel do so more out of fear of Iran, which is the biggest threat to everybody in the Middle East, whether it's the Jewish or Arab countries. And Bolton was interviewed on Israeli TV, J24, and he said without a doubt that's what he thought. We have a clip from that interview, which I thought was sort of interesting.
I think the agreements between Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Israel are significant steps forward. I think that it's not a reflection of Israel's diplomacy or the Trump administration's diplomacy. I think it's a reflection of the changed strategic reality created by the Iranian threat. I don't think Bahrain, for example, would have agreed to exchange diplomatic recognition with Israel unless Saudi Arabia was agreeable to it. We don't know who else may do the same in the near future, but I think more are likely to come. And this is a huge change in the region that even if Biden wins, he certainly cannot reverse. And I think it reflects the clear awareness of those closest to Iran what a threat Iran poses. And again, I underline not just its nuclear weapons program, but its terrorist support and its conventional military activities as well. And one final point on Iran. You know, by allowing Iran to have a uranium enrichment capability and a plutonium reprocessing capability, the 2015 deal encouraged nuclear proliferation in the region. Other countries, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, look at Iran and say, well, if they can have those capabilities, why shouldn't we? This is yet another problem with the 2015 deal. Not only didn't it constrain Iran effectively, it encouraged the others to do what Iran was doing. Well, the Saudis are, of course, the biggest of the energy producers in the Gulf. They've been the leader of the Gulf Cooperation Council for many years. The the king of Saudi Arabia is the keeper of the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, supervises the annual pilgrimage in the Muslim world. So I think the political significance there would be really stunning. And it would mark what people have been looking for 30 years or more, a new Middle East. So I think we're very close to it, and I think that that this is something that the Gulf Arab states want for their own security and their future well-being. They want to see the possibility of the marriage of Gulf money with Israeli science and technology and entrepreneurship, and I think it's a potentially very powerful combination. This, again, is why I think leaders in Europe have to rethink their vision of Iran's role in the region and globally, because things are changing, and I think changing very quickly.
That is John Bolton, who is an interesting guy on the outs with the administration right now, so you have to take with what he is saying with his...
a grain of salt.
Well, yeah, right. But,
I would say this also, because I feel like, yeah, I hear you, Bolton, but at the same time, you got to listen to the people. Like, when you listen to the Emirati ambassadors to the U.S., and you listen to the Emirati people, they're so excited. Same with the Bahrainians. And look, the UAE literally just opened their first kosher restaurant.
Right.
In the
tallest building in the world.
Right. In the luxury Armani Hotel situated in Dubai's, district. So it is, I guess it is the tallest building in the world, which, by the way, I would never want to go to the top of that. That would just freak me out. But I mean, this is, look, people are excited about this. I mean, you just had your first, literally the first historic direct flight, commercial airline flight from Israel, literally just landed in Bahrain this week. I mean, the first time in history. We had the first one for the UAE a couple of weeks ago. I mean, this is a big deal. This is really happening. People are super excited in that area of the world. It's like, you know, after things have been sort of in the stalemate forever, you see change. I mean, it's pretty exciting. And there was this piece in the Associated Press this week about the Saudi prince saying, you know, we will not be able to succeed without Israel. This goes to your point about the warming of ties. You know, talking about the Saudis and the Israelis coming together and getting, and having normalization. Publicly, we know behind the scenes they've been communicating for years. Saudi Arabia has opened its airspace. For the first time, you can fly over Saudi Arabia, and there's lots of things that are happening. Really exciting time, in the world. And then there's this other thing. If you look at Times of Israel, they talked about it. There was a historic webinar this week with media personnel from all over the Middle East, from Bahrain, the UAE. From Israel, was Oman on it as well? I think Oman.
It was pretty amazing with the little squares. It was a Zoom conference.
Yeah, and they're all talking all different languages, but participating and having dialogue, which that kind of normalization is still considered treason and unlawful in Gaza and illegal in the Palestinian Authority. But it was so cool to watch and see this happening and.
Things are changing. Why don't we do this? We have a terrific interview coming up with someone who's a world-renowned artist who spoke this week at a big event sponsored by Federation, Janet Eckelman. But first, let's take a quick break. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5.
Mike's interview with Janet Eckelman is coming right up. You know, if you want to learn more about Mike Deason and Laureen Jaffe, just navigate to our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com. There you can also browse the show archives and leave a comment or suggestion. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back. This is the Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. Two Jews, three opinions. So you were aware of the event coming this past week. Jamal Sowell, who we talked to last week, was one of the speakers at this event sponsored. It was sponsored by Federation, was it not?
Well, the Florida Israel Business Accelerator, which is under the Tampa Jewish Federation umbrella. So FIBA, had their annual event, and so it was very exciting. You know, they had technology and experts and speakers from all over Israel and here in the U.S. participate. Obviously, the Secretary of Commerce for the state of Florida would participate in that. But the key, one of the keynote speakers was a local Jewish artist who, for those of you who have not visited the brand new St. Pete, Florida pier, her art has a lot of technology and complexity to it, and it is displayed there, and it's beautiful.
It is. It is. But she's world renowned. She really is. And I've got to tell you that she is my wife's first cousin. So I am very, very familiar with Janet.
You're biased, Mike.
I am. But she's a spectacular person and a spectacular artist, and had a chance to talk to her. She lives in Brookline in Massachusetts, and which is a heavy-duty Jewish community. But anyway, let's listen to Janet Echelman. You started the other night when you started talking about how our family got to Tampa. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, my understanding is our family first left Europe in the 1880s by boat, that they were trying to get to New Orleans, but shipwrecked off of Key West. And they decided to settle and kept bringing over relatives and started a very small endeavor called the Ripa Brothers Cigar Factory. I think the word factory implies more than it was a wooden house where they made hand-rolled cigars. And around 1905, when my grandmother was about to start school, the only option in Key West was the convent. And so the family decided to move to Tampa, which was bigger and had a Jewish community and more educational options. So my family has been in the Tampa area since the beginning of the 1900s.
Well, you know, Lori and I, and for our listeners, Lori's my wife and Janet's first cousin, we found your grandma, the home your grandmother was born in when we were in Key West. It was a shotgun-style house, and it's sort of interesting. They had much nicer accommodations in Tampa.
I should mention that they formed the very first synagogue in Key West because there was no other existing Jewish community at that time.
Wow, I didn't realize that. I thought they moved here because there wasn't a congregation. That's interesting. So tell me about how I'm really moving it ahead a lot, but the thing that we're most interested in is your artwork and how you transition from what you initially started into what you're doing now. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I originally designed an artwork for a different location, and the city and the public decided that that area should remain a natural park with no structures on it. And so my art was moved to the center of the pier. And I discovered that it was the location where there had been something called the Spa Beach Pool, and that African Americans had protested there, and it eventually led to a Supreme Court case all the way to the United States Supreme Court, which ruled that all municipal pools and beaches in America could not discriminate and that everyone should have access. And this resonated so much with what the new pier is about. It's a welcoming, inclusive place to bring people together from all backgrounds, all ages. And my artwork, it's very important to me that it be able to speak to people from whatever walk of life, whatever cultural background, whatever age, that it is a human experience that crosses those kinds of boundaries. And in my greatest hopes, it helps bring us together.
It is spectacular. But I do know that you didn't start out doing this. First of all, describe, if you can, best that you can, how you what this is all about, because it's really unique. There's not much like this in the world that I know of, except unless it's an Eccleman piece.
My artwork are these monumental lace-like net structures, and they look incredibly delicate, but they are at the scale of big buildings or skyscrapers. It's 600 feet long, and it is moving delicately in the wind, but it's made of an incredibly highly engineered, strong fiber. It's what the NASA scientists use in space to tether the Mars rover, because this fiber is stronger than steel. It's, in fact, 15 times stronger than steel, pound for pound. So the sculpture is made of these very strong but delicate fiber networks that move in the wind. And during the day, the colors are blending with the sky in blues and whites, and it makes you notice and pay attention to the world that we're in, the sky and its changing weather. But at night, it begins to glow with warm, vibrant, colored light, and it really transforms. And what's been so exciting to me is to watch the piece become a part of life in St. Petersburg. I understand that every Sunday night there's a drumming circle, and that there were Black Lives Matter protests that decided to make the destination of their march from City Hall the sculpture itself, which is titled Bending Arc, which is, of course, referring to the bending arc of the moral universe and Martin Luther King's speech saying that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
How wonderful. Now, Janet, I know you were an acclaimed artist in another medium before you got into doing this, which has brought you great acclaim. Tell me how you transitioned from doing, what was it called, Batik? Is that what your initial, we have a bunch of your pieces.
My early work, I thought of myself as a painter. I used many different kinds of methods, including a craft technique using fabric dyes called batik, and also many different oil paints and acrylic paints and collage. So, but I would say that I was a painter for the first 10 years of my life as an artist. And after 10 years, I applied for a Fulbright to teach painting in India. And I shipped all of my special paints and brushes to India to create a new series of paintings. And the U.S. Embassy booked exhibition halls all around the country. And they were waiting for my paintings to arrive. But I was waiting for my materials to arrive so I could get started. And I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and they never arrived. And I was just stuck in a hard place. And I finally realized I was going to have to use what was there. And I happened to be in a fishing village in South India. And I was watching the fishermen reeling in their nets at the end of their work day. And I looked at that and I thought, oh, that's a way to create volumetric sculptural form without heavy, solid material. And of course, I didn't have enough money to buy heavy, solid materials to make bronze sculptures. So this way of using fiber and twine and knotting as a way to create large shapes that could then fold up small, because I didn't have money to ship these works, and yet they needed to be large to fill the exhibition halls. And so I would say that most of my life, everything good has come from something going wrong and my having to consider an option that never seemed plausible to me before.
Well, what a wonderful attitude to look at life like that. It is the classic turning lemons into lemonade, without a doubt. And now, did you have immediate success? I know you were in Barcelona. You did stuff for the Olympics. Didn't you do something for Microsoft? I mean, you've had such tremendous success with this form of art. Did it catch on immediately?
I don't know. There was interest from the beginning, and it was gradual. I think step by step. I would say it's been a really long and slow path. But eventually it did lead to a commission for the Vancouver Winter Olympics. It did eventually lead to a commission for the Vancouver Winter Olympics that is a permanent legacy project. And it did lead to a permanent commission for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in downtown Seattle. And it has led me all over the world and this country. Right now, the Smithsonian American Art Museum just opened an installation of my work at the Renwick Gallery that all of you are invited to go to once you travel again. It is free to the public, as the Smithsonian is. And to cities all around the world, Amsterdam, Madrid, London, Santiago, Chile, Singapore, Shanghai, Beijing, Dubai, all over the world. And these are experiences that I could only have dreamed of. So, but I would say that none is more meaningful to me than the new piece, which is in my hometown, on the coast of Tampa Bay, where I grew up. So, I hope that you and your listeners will come to the St. Pete Pier and experience Bending Arc. And I would encourage you to come at sunset and to watch it change colors from day to night.
Well, Janet, you are a complete example of resiliency. Didn't you say that a lot of art schools rejected you when you initially decided to go into art?
That's completely true. I decided that my dream was to be an artist, and I thought the way you do that is to go to art school. So I applied to the 7 leading art schools around the United States, and I was rejected by all 7 of them.
Betcha they're kicking themselves today.
So it forced me to have to confront whether I really must do this or whether it was just, you know, a fleeting idea. And I realized that this was the life I wanted and that I would have to find my own way and find my own teachers in a different way. And I applied to the local Tampa Bay Rotary Clubs, who nominated me for the Rotary Foundation Fellowship, which enabled me to have a year of study abroad as an ambassador of goodwill. Thank you to the Tampa Bay Interbay Rotary Club. And from there, I began to experiment with traditional arts. I started with, I was at the University of Hong Kong. I started learning Chinese brush painting. And from there, I had $300 in my pocket and a plane ticket. And I decided I was just going to give it my all, and I moved to Bali, Indonesia, and started studying their craft techniques, batik and weaving and all of their textile crafts that have been handed down generation to generation. My thinking was that anything that wasn't worthy would have been forgotten, and that these traditions that have lasted from generation to generation hold great wisdom. And I was going to study from those traditions instead of art school. And that has directed my life. My early paintings were very much informed by craft techniques. And after 10 years, when my paints went missing in India, and I had to create new art, I also turned to humble crafts. This was fishermen making the nets that they used to eat to earn their living. And you know, I'm still doing this. It's now 20 years that I've been refining and improving and learning how to bring this ancient craft form of knotting fishing nets to an art form at the scale of buildings, like architecture, with very robust engineering, with materials, aramid fibers that are incredibly strong, and aeronautical engineers analyze the sculpture for wind load and snow load and ice load and all of the weather that my outdoor work needs to withstand. My piece in St. Pete, Florida at the pier is designed for 150 miles per hour of wind. And just, if you like numbers, it's made of more than a million knots. In fact, 1,662,528 knots.
But who's counting?
And the piece itself, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And it's made from 180 miles of twine.
Wow. Wow. Well, how long did it take to construct that, Janet?
Yeah, I've been working on this piece for 4 years, but in the middle, when the sculpture was moved to a new location and I discovered the civil rights history of this spot, it really forced me to think about some of the stories of my own childhood. I remember my grandmother, Lillian Einbinder, telling me that as a child, she remembered signs on the beaches in St. Petersburg that said, "No Jews, coloreds, or dogs allowed." And this was a traumatic thing for me, not having experienced it myself, but knowing and hearing about it through my grandmother's experience. And it really made me feel that it was important to talk about Bending Arc and its importance for the African American community and also all the communities in the United States who experienced discrimination. The importance of the Bending Arc of social justice speaks to every one of us. And I'm very excited to see my piece at more than 400 feet to be a reminder to us of the importance of social and civil rights for every single American, and that it affects every one of us if it affects any one of us. For your listeners who enjoy radio, I want to bring their attention to the BBC World Service. They did a 30-minute in-depth following of me on this project over the last several years, and it's called In the Studio with the BBC.
And can we get it online?
Yes.
Thanks, Janet. Happy New Year to you and everybody, and look forward to seeing you soon. Okay?
Lashana to you and all your listeners.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. So, listen, the BBC documentary about her putting all of this stuff together is available online. Just search Janet Echelman and look for that BBC documentary, because that's pretty exciting.
And I want people to go see her art. If you're local, go to the St. Pete Pier, check it out. I think you would be very impressed. So, but a couple of big things that happened this week that we talked about just in follow-up to last week and the week before. So, Mike and I had talked about Leila Khalid. Leila Khalid, who was involved in two different hijackings of planes with a terrorist organization that's been identified by the U.S., Israel, I think Canada, the European Union. So very interesting. So obviously she was designated as a guest speaker at San Francisco State University. And she was involved in the hijacking of two planes, one in 1969 and one in 1970, as a member of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. And she was scheduled to speak this past week, September 23rd. It was a conference called Whose Narrative? Gender, Justice, and Resistance. And she was sort of put forth as this freedom fighter,
Who has no remorse.
First of all, she has not renounced her association with the terrorist organization, and she has not renounced nor has any remorse for her hijackings, which did result in innocent people dying. And by the way, what was also interesting, she really never served time, because that flight, the LL flight, landed in London, and then she was set free during a prisoner exchange because other people had been hijacked. For those of you who remember a lot of the plane hijackings that were happening in the late 60s, early 70s, so she was swapped in a prisoner exchange. She never even served time for her crime. So, obviously the Anti-Defamation League, and countless organizations, Jewish organizations throughout California, were just, just crying bloody murder. The Lawfare Project, obviously very active, wrote letters to the U.S. Justice Department, to the university, and so as did the ADL, et cetera. So ultimately, Zoom, because it was going to be hosted on Zoom, Zoom withdrew and said, nope, you can't host it with us because it is identified as a terrorist organization, the organization she's associated with. It said, in light of the speaker, so this is Zoom, and it says, and this quote, it says, in light of the speaker's reported affiliation or membership in a U.S. designated foreign terrorist organization and SFSU's inability to confirm otherwise, we determined the meeting is in violation of Zoom's terms of service and told SFSU they may not use Zoom for this particular event. So that was tremendous. So I applaud Zoom. Facebook had a similar position. And so what we learned was that that the day of the event, what the university tried to do was host it on YouTube. And within 20 minutes, YouTube shut it down. And then again, I think I read somewhere that they tried to put on another YouTube channel and YouTube shut it down.
Hooray, hooray.
Thank God. Baruch Hashem is all I can say that, this woman is not talking to, 18, 19, 20 year olds about how to be, terrorist.
Hey, listen,
unbelievable.
Before we run out of time, we've talked about this before a little bit. First of all, there is a suburb or a city in New York State named Swastika, and the residents don't want to allow the name of the city to be changed. And remember we talked that there was a subdivision in Tampa named Swastika?
Yes, a while ago, yeah.
A long time ago. Well, Linda Saulcena, who is Jewish, who was on city council at the time, she and John Dingfelder, who's back on city council, made a move to get rid of the name and to change it. And I got a hold of Linda today just to get a quick little thought about that whole incident. You might find that interesting. This is Linda Saulcena. So as I recall, Linda, it was brought to you guys. You guys were shocked, right?
Absolutely. No one had any idea that there was a swastika subdivision.
So what happened when you found out about it?
We decided to change the name. And like anything that is official, it takes forever, and the legal department gets involved and tells you all the reasons why it's very difficult. But we eventually were successful and changed it. I can't remember what we changed it to, but it was not swastika.
Yeah, but was there any pushback from folks like the folks in New York are now pushing back on changing their town name?
No, because most people had no idea that it was even a name. When we tried to change Buffalo Avenue to Dr. Martin Luther King Boulevard, there was a huge pushback because people were cognizant of that, and there were a lot of, people who didn't like Dr. Martin Luther King. But with the swastika, I don't remember any opposition to it.
And as I recall, it was a unanimous vote by council.
That's my memory also.
Yeah, long, long time ago. Well, it just puts some perspective into the folks. What do you think about this New York suburb that doesn't want to change?
I'm shocked, absolutely shocked. In this day and age, I think it's incredibly insensitive of them.
So, at least here in Tampa, we don't have a subdivision named Swastika, but in New York State, they do, and the people won't change it, which...
I thought their reasoning was interesting. So, I've heard this before. So in Sanskrit, Sanskrit is the ancient Hindu language. And Sanskrit does have a swastika, which represents... I don't know. I don't want to say it represents to prosper. I think it's more like a good omen.
Oh yeah, Hitler co-opted that. He did not invent
right.
that.
Right, he took it from right. Right. I don't think it was you, Mike. I don't know if it was you or someone else. But I remember talking to a friend who was in India, and they were. And this is many, many, many years ago when they were at a dedication. I believe it was of a. It could have been a Buddhist temple, but I believe it was a Hindu temple. And the foundation cornerstone had a swastika on it. And he was like, whoa, what is that?
We looked at a house on Davis Islands a gazillion years ago that they had tile out on the porch in swastika, and both my wife and I went, no, thank you very much. So, but
right.
Lorene,
right.
You hear that,
right.
That music? That means we are out of time. I want to wish everybody a happy new year, an easy fast, Shana Tova.
May you all be inscribed and sealed for a good, healthy, prosperous new year ahead.
Amen. And that's it. Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Bye.
That's all for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for listening.